to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the 31st Annual Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is a double issue and covers December 2024 and January of 2025. And this is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the continuation of Karen Reed's Fight by Julie Miller. As in any relationship, issues bubbled up. O'Keefe resented that Reed got to do the fun parts of parenting while he played disciplinarian, she says. When the kids returned from a trip with their grandparents, Reed recalls that Kaylee and Patrick walked past O'Keefe to hug her first. O'Keefe felt the kids preferred Reed because she spoiled them with go-karts, fancy haircuts, and shopping trips. She thought they could feel her warmth and O'Keefe's stress. He never adequately mourned his sister, according to Reed, and struggled to manage his own grief, plus the children's increasingly complicated needs, emotional and otherwise. O'Keefe saw a therapist with them at one point, but when the shrink introduced board games, O'Keefe checked out. I think that's part of his stock, Reed contemplates now. This Irish Catholic, south of Boston, rub some dirt on it, drink through your problems mindset. Drinking increased for both of them on weekends, which she now regrets, but rationalized at the time as them unwinding after a hard week. Once O'Keefe had a drink or two, that was when he was the most relaxed, says Reed. He would be easygoing, but then it was this vicious cycle that he's hung over the next day. During a New Year's group vacation in Aruba, Reed says, O'Keefe and his friends cracked beers at 10 a.m. and drank till sundown or man down, whichever came first. She says she caught O'Keefe kissing another woman. The woman denied it at trial. That same January, Reed engaged in her own flirtation. She exchanged text with one of O'Keefe's contacts, Brian Higgins, an ATF agent. It was a brief thing and petered out as quickly as it started. I knew Higgins found me attractive, she says. It helped me emotionally validate myself, which is embarrassing to admit. Nowhere to be found. On Friday night, January 28, 2022, Reed and O'Keefe had been drinking with O'Keefe's buddies at the Waterfall in Canton, the kind of bar where flat-screen TVs are permatuned to sports and friends trade shots. Canton is a quaint cop town 15 miles southwest of Boston, just past the skirt of suburbs that are untouchable under seven figures, where the state's major highways intersect, making it a prime blue-collar community where homes are passed down over generations. It was around midnight, and snow had just begun falling when Brian Albert invited everyone in the group to his house afterward for drinks. The former Marine and 30-year BPD veteran headed the fugitive apprehension team and had appeared on the Donnie Wahlberg-produced reality show Boston's Finest. As one of seven siblings raised in town, he seemed to know or be related to everyone. His younger brother Kevin is a Canton cop, and another younger brother, Chris, is a town select board member. That night, Reed and O'Keefe were joined by a cluster of the veteran cop's family members, his wife, Nicole, his brother, Chris, Chris's wife, Julie, Nicole's sister, Jennifer McCabe, and McCabe's husband, Matt, plus Higgins and an unrelated couple, Karina and Nicholas Kalakithis. When Reed woke up the next morning, panicked that O'Keefe was not home, she met up with two of his friends, Jennifer McCabe, who was at the Albert home when Reed dropped O'Keefe off, and Carrie Roberts, to look for him. At about 6 a.m., the women pulled up to the Albert's house at 34 Fairview. and Reed spotted O'Keefe in the front yard. Hysterical, she jumped out, cleared snow from her boyfriend's bruised and bloodied face, and began mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Roberts administered chest compressions, and McCabe called 911. At times, Reed lay on top of O'Keefe, desperately trying to heat his body, which had cooled to 80 degrees. Emergency vehicles raced onto Fairview moments later, their red lights beaming into the dark sky and bouncing off the snow. It was such a spectacle that a neighbor snapped photos. Neither Albert nor any of his family members emerged from the house as first responders attempted to save O'Keefe's life. Even in her confusion, Reed clocked this. She wondered whether she had dropped her boyfriend off at the wrong house. And after a night of drinking, O'Keefe entered an aggressive stranger's home. The Alberts say they slept through the noise. The neighbor who snapped photos opines to Vanity Fair that Albert's explanation absolutely does not make sense. Reed was so distraught that she was taken to Good Samaritan Hospital for evaluation. EMTs delivered her around 8 a.m., about the same time O'Keefe was pronounced dead of hypothermia and blunt force trauma to the head. The patient is hysterical. She is actively grieving. She states she does not belong in care. She just wants to know what happened to her boyfriend, observed attending physician Jonathan Rice, who noted that Reed had blood on her face and hands. The doctor also noted no psychiatric history and that Reed denied any SIHIAHVH, meaning no suicidal or homicidal ideation and no auditory or visual hallucinations. He also noted that Reed worried continually about her husband because they had two adopted kids, and she stated she cannot live without him. When Reed's father, Bill, arrived at the hospital, a nurse briefed him. "Your daughter wants to know whether or not John O'Keefe is dead." "We can tell her, you can tell her, or you can tell her with us present." "I'll tell her," Bill said. He was led to Reed's room, where he told his daughter simply, "He's gone." Reed insisted that her father take her to O'Keefe's house to see Kaylee and Patrick. The rest of the O'Keefe family was already there, including his mother, Margaret, who goes by Peg, his father, John Sr., and his brother, Paul. They had also come from the hospital, where they identified the officer's body and saw his gruesome condition laid bare under the bright lights. The adults gathered around the kitchen island, and Reed asked the family what O'Keefe looked like. "He looked like he went 5 rounds with Mike Tyson," was Paul's response, according to the Reeds. "They say Peg made her own assessment. I think he looks like he got hit by a car." Reed was thunderstruck by the unexpected hostility. Her family realized it was time to leave. Reed and her father went upstairs to quickly pack her medication and several belongings. Then she hugged and kissed Patrick and Kaylee for what would be the last time. A few days later, Reed was court-ordered to refrain from contacting the O'Keefe family. "I felt like all of a sudden this went from being my house to I am persona non grata," she told me. As they left, she told her father, "Dad, I don't know what happened, but I feel like Peg thinks I did something." When they got home, Bill Reed searched criminal defense attorneys in Boston. David Yannetti's name and picture popped up. Yannetti had spent the first decade of his career as a prosecutor. As the Middlesex assistant DA, he put two men behind bars for one of the county's most heinous crimes, the 1997 rape and murder of 10-year-old Jeffrey Curley, whose attackers lured him with the promise of a new bicycle. Bill's vetting was more on instinct. A devout Catholic who prays every day and paid his way through college by working as a night guard in Fall River, Bill decided on Yannetti because he looked like an honest man. Massachusetts State Police were moving quickly. They seized Reed's car and phone less than 12 hours after O'Keefe was declared dead. She knew she was a suspect, but her devastation trumped fear. She was still confused why O'Keefe's body was on Albert's lawn and was shocked he was dead. I'd been with him all week, she told me. We had been intimate the night before, and now he's gone. Yannetti told Reed to prepare for an arrest. So racked by grief and disbelief, she zombie-walked through her morning ritual. She showered, did her makeup, blew out her hair, picked out a sweater that would be comfortable in jail, and waited for hours on the overstuffed white couch in her living room, where I sat while she recounted this story. 3 days after O'Keefe's death, she was taken into police custody. An attractive, highly educated finance professional, accused of killing her cop boyfriend and leaving his body on another cop's lawn, was catnip to Boston media. The morning after her arrest, cameras rolled as she was escorted in handcuffs to her arraignment. She pleaded not guilty to all charges and was released on $50,000 bail. A cousin with a criminal record called her with advice. I've pled to charges where I wasn't even in the state where the crime happened. I wanted to get out of jail. I couldn't post bail, and I didn't have David Yannetti. The cousin warned her that prosecutors don't always care if they have the right guy, as long as they have someone behind bars. That's a closed file for them, he said, then added, question everything. Yannetti received a different kind of call on February 2nd, within hours of Reed's arraignment. A man with a gravelly voice, claiming to have a background in Boston law enforcement, made an explosive claim. He told Yannetti that Brian Albert and his nephew had beaten up O'Keefe on January 29th. When O'Keefe didn't come to, said this mysterious man, Albert and an unnamed federal agent put O'Keefe's body on the front lawn. When Yannetti called him back for a more thorough interview, he backtracked, saying he was only speculating based on photos of O'Keefe in the news, and he ultimately recanted the tip altogether. But Yannetti points out that photos of O'Keefe hadn't been released at the time of the first call, and other details from the tip lined up. Higgins, the ATF agent, had been drinking at the Albert home that morning, as had Albert's nephew, Colin. Until the tipster's call, Reed and Yannetti hadn't known that Colin was at the house, as he later testified he was, because his name was not in police reports. In February, a funeral was held for O'Keefe in Braintree. Dozens of Boston police officers saluted O'Keefe's casket as it was carried into St. Francis of Assisi Church. Bagpipes skirled a solemn hymn as a giant American flag waved in the wind. Reed was not there, in part because of the stay-away order, but views the pomp as performative. This whole Irish cop departed bagpipe thing, says Reed, trailing off. There's nothing holy about this, she says. I think it is the biggest farce, maybe only second to my trial, that the people who were there in the cold outside the church were nowhere to be found in terms of actually delivering justice to John O'Keefe. A breakup when kids are involved is a high-stakes decision. In January 2022, despite their troubles, neither O'Keefe nor Reed were willing to give up on the family dynamic they had forged with Kaylee and Patrick. That fateful night, they still loved each other. They cuddled at the waterfall, as security footage shows, and witnesses described them as affectionate. Albert invited the group back to his house to celebrate his son's 23rd birthday. Beyond a bar run-in the week before O'Keefe died, he'd never really socialized with Albert, even though both were BPD living in Canton and had McCabe in common. Albert had an alluring reputation. He helped unmask the Boston Strangler in 2013 and capture the Craigslist killer before that. The night he died, O'Keefe was eager to join up for a nightcap. When he and Reed arrived at 34 Fairview, though, she wondered whether they were at the right address. There weren't many cars in the driveway, and Reed felt uneasy. McCabe had conveyed the invitation, so Reed wasn't sure how welcome the couple actually were. O'Keefe said he'd check out the scene and report back. But minutes passed without word. I got pissed, Reed tells me now. She knew that a woman O'Keefe used to hook up with lived a few houses down the street. He's got to be screwing around, she thought. I didn't think he was physically incapacitated. After about 10 minutes of waiting, Reed drove to O'Keefe's house to be with Kaylee, who was home alone. To Reed, it felt like Aruba all over again, so recent. She sent O'Keefe a barrage of angry voicemails and texts. John, I'm going home. You're effing using me right now. You're effing another girl. Kaylee is sleeping next to me. John, I effing hate you. This is effing dirty. 4 months after Reed was first charged, Massachusetts State Police were back at Reed's house to arrest her again, this time for second-degree murder. She and Yannetti were stunned. She didn't know a rearrest was possible, and her lawyer hadn't been given a heads-up. Defendants can be upcharged when significant new evidence is discovered, but Reed and Yannetti considered the additional evidence cited to be a stretch. In an interview, Patrick had claimed O'Keefe and Reed argued a decent amount of time, and Kaylee recalled O'Keefe telling Reed their relationship was over, with Reed refusing to leave the house. The Commonwealth also cited Reed's estimated blood alcohol level based on a sample taken at the hospital. That second arrest was Yannetti and Reed's first clue that something was, as they say, amiss. It was so dirty and underhanded that they would go behind my back, Yannetti tells me by phone. The DA requested Reed's bail be set at $500,000. I believe it was to scare me and get some kind of plea deal going, Reed says of the second arrest. Do 2 years on a lesser manslaughter charge and you'll be free, which we were never going to consider. At Reed's second arraignment, Yannetti argued that his client had reason not to flee. Her Crohn's and multiple sclerosis treatments were here in Boston. Cannon set Reed's bail at a comparatively low $100,000. The day after I'm upcharged, David's like, listen, I know this is the worst time to have this conversation, but my fees double for murder, says Reed. The fees weren't as frightening as the legal shock, though. At that point, says Reed, David and I realize this is effing dirty. This is not you said something that was taken the wrong way at the scene and they got the wrong guy. This is intentional. They're framing me. By September 2022, Reed and Yannetti were running into repeated roadblocks trying to get basic evidence from the Commonwealth. They hoped to get Google geofence data, which would identify every cell phone on the Alberts property on January 29th. Desperate for guidance, Reed emailed Alan Jackson, an L.A.-based lawyer who used cell phone data to get a 2019 groping case against Kevin Spacey dropped. Jackson had worked the other side, too. As an L.A. County prosecutor, he put Phil Spector behind bars for the 2003 murder of Lena Clarkson. Since then, he's built a reputation as one of California's top and most expensive trial lawyers, representing a Venice Beach hotel owner charged with murder, an NBA player facing domestic assault charges, and a 22-year-old Bakersfield man who stabbed his brother in self-defense. He managed to avoid jail time for all of them. Jackson gets more than 100 representation requests monthly, but the subject line of Reed's email stood out, murder of a Boston cop. He clicked on it and read her plea. I am fighting for my life against a blue wall. And therefore, marshaling whatever resources advice I can find. On a call with Reed, Jackson agreed to share his cell phone data-related motions and asked to hear more about her case. After learning that she was being accused of fatally hitting O'Keefe with her SUV, the lawyer asked to see photos of O'Keefe's injuries. Reed immediately sent over a few, revealing O'Keefe's bruised and swollen eyes and the cuts above his right eye and nose. But it was O'Keefe's right arm, which looked like it had been clawed, that caused Jackson to exclaim, "That's an animal attack!" Jackson later said by phone, "If there's any medical examiner or DA or lead investigator out there claiming that's from a car, that's bullshit. And if that's not true, what else isn't true?" In the photos, surveillance video from C.F. McCarthy's, a bar in Canton, Massachusetts, an autopsy photo of O'Keefe's arm injuries, and Reed's Lexus SUV. Good, bad, ugly. The police theory of what happened that night is evident in the charges. But what Reed and her defense team believe happened involves a fatal fusion of alcohol, testosterone, and bad luck. They allege that O'Keefe encountered some combination of Brian Albert, Brian Higgins, and Colin Albert in the basement, and a fight turned dangerously violent. According to O'Keefe's Apple Health data, after 12:20 a.m., about the time when Reed dropped the police officer off, he took 80 steps, the equivalent of half of a football field, and went up or down three floors. Witnesses inside the Albert home that night deny O'Keefe ever went inside. The defense's theory holds that O'Keefe's body was moved to the yard. Reed's defense offers several possible catalysts for a disagreement, such as Higgins' flirtation with Reed. Higgins, who testified he did not encounter O'Keefe after the bar, did not respond to Vanity Fair's questions. Another is O'Keefe's allegedly antagonistic relationship with Colin Albert, who lived two doors down from him. According to Reed, the teenager regularly dumped beer bottles and cans on the lawn. Colin testified that there was no animosity with O'Keefe and that he left the Albert home around midnight before O'Keefe was dropped off. He did not respond to Vanity Fair's questions. Or there's the idea that Brian Albert might have simply been irritated by the likes of O'Keefe, who was given special accommodations by the BPD after his sister's death, like a desk job with flexible hours. I could see how someone could look at John and say, "I'm a real cop. I'm the head of the fugitive unit. I've been on the drug unit, the gang unit," Reed imagines to me. Albert's spokesperson, Greg Henning, denies the idea that there was ever beef or any physical altercation. He adds that Albert attended a fundraiser in support of Kristen. He also noted that Albert attended O'Keefe's wake to grieve with the family. In any of these scenarios, the defense believes, the Albert's German Shepherd, Chloe, was a factor. She was being kept in the basement part of that night because she was not great with strangers, Albert admitted to the court. She was not great with other dogs, either. A Canton resident told Vanity Fair that in 2018, she was walking her golden doodle past the Albert yard when Chloe attacked her dog so aggressively that she was not able to stop the German Shepherd until someone emerged from the Albert home and called Chloe's name. The owner took her dog, covered in blood, to the veterinarian, who told her that Chloe needed to be reported to animal control. Based on the severity and location of the bite, the vet said it looked as though Chloe wanted to kill the dog. But when the woman called Canton police, she was told that animal control was out and that police could not tell her when the animal control officer would be back. After she left her information with Canton police, she says that Kevin Albert, Brian's brother and a Canton cop, contacted the woman's husband with a message from the then police chief, "How can we make this thing go away?" Neither Kevin nor Canton police responded to Vanity Fair's questions. The woman became so nervous walking past the Albert house afterward that she started to carry pepper spray. About 3 months after O'Keefe's death, Chloe attacked another dog and bit a woman who tried to intervene. That woman confirmed to Vanity Fair. Another woman was injured while trying to help. The Alberts subsequently rehomed their dog of 7 years. That was not the only major change for the Albert family. In 2023, Brian Albert retired from law enforcement due to a shoulder injury incurred on the job, says Henning, and his maximum pension had been reached. The same year, the Alberts also sold the home on Fairview that had been in their family for decades. Henning denies that either decision was related to the case. He says that the family considered selling in 2021, before O'Keefe's death, but eventually did so because the Albert children had grown up and moved out. When the new owners moved in, flooring had been removed from the basement, where Reed's defense team claims the fatal altercation with O'Keefe took place. But Henning said that was a modification that a real estate agent suggested following 2021 water damage, among other updates. I believe whatever happened to John was a setup to teach him a lesson or tune him up, and it got out of control. No one would choose to kill someone in their own home and then set it up so sloppily, Reed tells me. But that is where her willingness to make sense of everything ends. I hold the district attorney, who passed the bar and went to law school, to a higher standard. The power that a district attorney has in any given county is staggering. It's scary, she said. He can bring all the resources of the state to try to get a pound of flesh, which I believe is what he's doing. Reed spent her first months after O'Keefe's death mourning him, reminiscing, and trying to distract herself from her predicament. She wallpapered the house, cooked with her mother, and read Alexandre Dumas' classic, The Count of Monte Cristo, in which the protagonist is framed and arrested but ultimately escapes and avenges himself, has been an inspiration. Reed was still so confounded by O'Keefe's death that she was open to the idea that she could have accidentally hit him. I told my parents, if I did anything in any way, I'll pay my dues, she says now. That's how this should work. I want to know the truth. Good, bad, ugly. She hired a private investigator and even sought out materials that could prove she was guilty, like security footage from the Albert home. But Albert said he never installed a camera his wife gave him, nor was there security footage from homes on the street. The homeowner across from the Alberts, who works for Canton Police, told Reed's private investigator that his camera did not pick up anything from 34 Fairview. Security footage from the library that Reed drove by between 12:37 a.m. and 12:39 a.m. should have shown whether her taillight was smashed, but that precise two-minute time frame of the video was missing when the Commonwealth turned it over to Reed's team. The Commonwealth says they turned over the entirety of the video that the Canton PD gave them. Reed told me about a rumor that there are texts between her and her lawyer in which she implicates herself, text that police supposedly read when they confiscated her phone, but that will never be released because they're privileged. Proctor, the state trooper, himself referenced an exchange on the stand, saying that he stopped looking through her phone when he saw messages between Reed and an attorney. But Reed and Yannetti each point out that they didn't communicate until after Massachusetts State Police had seized her phone and car. I didn't even have a cell phone number for David until several hours after Proctor left with my phone, Reed says. I never texted him on January 29th. Proctor testifying on the witness stand that he saw text between David and me is a provable lie. Reed has pored over tens of thousands of pages of legal filings and police reports. She has played the waterfall security footage on repeat. She has scanned every text, screenshot, and Google search on O'Keefe's phone for buried clues. Initially, it was difficult to look at O'Keefe's autopsy photos, and torture to imagine, what did he feel? Did he know he was freezing? Was he waiting for me to come back? She has scoured social media, going down rabbit holes of Facebook posts featuring Proctor with various Albert family members, even a post where Proctor's mom called Chris and Colin Albert her second family. A courtesy to the family. When the trial began in April, meanwhile, Adam Lally, A prosecutor who has worked for the Norfolk County DA's office since 2010 assured the court that Proctor had no conflicts. "These are not people that know each other," Lally said. The prosecution produced 68 witnesses, at least 9 of whom were related to Albert by blood or marriage. Reed had 6, including a snowplow driver employed by Canton. Lally did not respond to Vanity Fair's questions. Leading up to the trial, Reed's team struggled to get basic discovery items, like crime scene photos. "Even that was a fight," says Elizabeth Little, another California lawyer on Reed's team. "We did numerous discovery requests, filed a motion to compel. We were given JPEG copies of photographs of zero metadata that were blurry and useless." After 7 months of litigation, it comes out that they don't have the original photos. They came from a phone. The phone doesn't exist anymore. Initially, you think it's just incompetence. The more we dug, the more we realized that the stuff we were looking for was never gathered in the first place or was being intentionally withheld. It became hard to believe it was all an accident or mistake. Proctor seemed problematically conflicted from the outset. The investigator appeared in social media photos with various Alberts and McCabes dating back to 2012. Though Proctor seized Reed's car and phone the day of O'Keefe's death, he did not interview Cullen for another year and 6 months. Then the interview went unrecorded. Proctor's sister Courtney is such good friends with Albert's sister-in-law Julie that they shared 67 phone calls in the 7 months after Reed's first arrest. At trial, Julie said she couldn't remember how many calls. On the day of Reed's first arrest, Courtney texted Proctor that an Albert family member said, "When this is all over, she wants to get you a thank you gift." Proctor asked that she get his wife a thank you gift instead. "Forget about the allegations of the victim being killed inside the house," says Doug Lewison, a Boston defense attorney who has represented law enforcement for 4 decades, but who was not working on the Reed case. He, like many legal analysts, believes Reed should never have been tried for second-degree murder. "As soon as these people who Proctor was acquainted with were identified as witnesses, he should have dropped out of the case. It was a system failure by the state police." Instead, Proctor declared Reed guilty via text the day he started his investigation. About 6 months later, while the probe was underway, Proctor and Albert's brother Kevin, the Canton cop, went out drinking. The next day, Proctor texted Kevin that he left his badge in Proctor's cruiser. Kevin responded, "Did I take my gun?" On the morning of January 29th, when McCabe's 911 call about O'Keefe being found on Albert's lawn came in, it was Kevin's Canton Police Department co-workers who responded. One called 2 off-duty officers to report to the scene, including Sergeant Michael Lank, who has known the Albert brothers since childhood. In 2002, while Lank was off-duty and drinking, he ran into Chris Albert, who told him that he had been harassed by a pair of brothers. Lank got into a fistfight, summoned police backup, punched one alleged assailant in the face, and was accused of spitting in the face of another while he was handcuffed. Lank settled a federal case, but testified that he would have come to similar defense for a civilian. Before police stepped into the Albert home the morning of O'Keefe's death, they sent McCabe inside to wake up its residents. Then they interviewed McCabe and the Alberts together for about 10 minutes, without recording the conversation or searching the house. Canton Police Lieutenant Paul Gallagher testified that they only interviewed McCabe and did not separate her from the Alberts when doing so. The officer said they had no reason to believe O'Keefe had ever been inside. McCabe did not respond to Vanity Fair's questions. The Commonwealth's key physical evidence against Reed has been her right taillight. No piece of Reed's car was found during a daylight search on January 29th, after snow had been cleared from the yard with a leaf blower. Reed, her family, and a Dighton police officer who witnessed Proctor seizing the car hours later say that Reed's taillight was only cracked at that point. Damage, Reed says, was inflicted when she backed out of O'Keefe's garage to search for him and bumped into his SUV, which was caught on O'Keefe's security camera. Despite Proctor's affidavit declaring he picked up Reed's car at 5:30 p.m., Dighton police and the Reed's security camera showed that he took the car at 4:12 p.m., a time to which the Commonwealth conceded a year and a half later. Reed thinks this discrepancy was to make it seem as though her car was not in police custody when pieces of her taillight were found. After her Lexus was in law enforcement custody, Reed believes her taillight was completely smashed. It wasn't until Proctor greenlit a state emergency response team search after 5:30 p.m. in the dark when pieces of the taillight were found in the Albert yard. 1 week later, after multiple searches by law enforcement, former Canton Police Chief Ken Berkowitz reported spotting more taillight pieces in the yard from his moving vehicle during a random drive-by. Reed says that she has always considered the taillight to be the cornerstone of the whole case. "It's the only concrete evidence that connects me to that crime scene," she says. No evidence was found until they had the evidence. The taillight was not the only discrepancy that came up at trial. The snowplow driver, a witness for Reed's defense, was adamant that he saw nobody when he drove by at 2:45 a.m. His truck has a high vantage point and bright lights, he noted, and he constantly scanned his periphery for obstacles. When he passed the house a second time, about 3:15 a.m., he saw a Ford Edge, the same model car Albert drives, parked in front. "This was unusual," he said, "because the Albert family normally does not park on the street, and it is standard protocol for him to call in a vehicle on the side of the road." During cross-examination, the prosecution presented a different timeline, calling into question the driver's account. As a courtesy to the family, whom he has known for decades, he didn't call it in. 32,709 text. In Massachusetts, defendants need court approval to subpoena documents or physical evidence. Canon agreed to a hearing in May 2023, before the trial began, to determine whether Reed could subpoena phone records from Albert and McCabe, but they opposed the motion. Canon canceled the court date and denied Reed's request. 2 months later, Reed's team asked Canon to recuse herself, claiming the appearance of bias. Aidan Kearney, the blogger known as Turtle Boy, who has been covering Reed's case, said he received Facebook direct messages from a McCabe family member suggesting family ties to Auntie Bev. Canon rejected that motion too, saying, "I've never socialized with McCabe or any family members or witnesses who have been here in court." She added, "I reject the notion that untrue and unsubstantiated rumors spread on the internet can force a judge to recuse herself from a case." Less than a month later, Kearney reported that Canone's brother, attorney John Prescott Jr., represented Chris Albert in a motor vehicle homicide case after he killed a foreign exchange student in 1994 and subsequently led police on a 30-hour manhunt. Chris was sentenced to 6 months in prison. Vanity Fair has spoken to a source confirming Canone's brother represented Chris Albert. At the time this story went to print, Canon was slated to preside over Reed's second trial. Canon declined to respond to all of Vanity Fair's questions. A year after O'Keefe's death, Reed got a partial extraction of McCabe's phone. Contrary to the Massachusetts State Police report, which found no relevant search history, Reed's expert Richard Green discovered that McCabe Googled How Long to Die in Cold at 2:27 a.m. on January 29th and later deleted the search. He determined that McCabe also deleted 18 phone calls from that day, including calls to her sister Nicole, Brian Elbert's wife, at 6:07 a.m. and 6:08 a.m. that were answered, though the Alberts said they slept through the commotion of the discovery of O'Keefe's body. Their bedroom overlooks the front yard. During trial, McCabe denied making that Google search before 6 a.m., claiming that she only did so at Reed's request after O'Keefe's body was discovered. She also denied deleting the search, denied that Nicole picked up her phone calls that morning, and denied deleting phone calls from her call log. The prosecution's expert said the 2:27 a.m. timestamp is not indicative of the time of the search, claiming that McCabe could have searched in a window opened at 2:27 a.m. Vanity Fair asked Umit Karabaik, a Ph.D. at Purdue's Department of Computer and Information Technology, who specializes in iPhone artifacts and the limitations of digital forensics, to evaluate the prosecution's expert testimony, as well as an affidavit from Reed's expert. Based on my research and expertise, I concur with what I see in the affidavit from Richard Green, Karabaik emailed Vanity Fair, referring to Reed's expert. Though the browser tab was opened earlier than the searches, Karabaik said, the timestamp for the search items is recorded for searches and stored in the database, not the time of the tab opening. He noted that Green additionally verified the search times with associated WAL files that are occasionally overlooked. Jackson's cross-examination of McCabe became so heated, with the prosecution witness repeatedly asking to see her prior grand jury statements, that, as one juror told Vanity Fair, it felt like they should have been served drinks and appetizers. Supposedly, this is the most traumatic thing of your life, and you don't remember what you said? That juror adds, there were so many things, so many times I wanted to just yell out, can you shut up? Just tell the truth. Just tell the truth. O'Keefe's death wasn't the first time Norfolk County law enforcement found themselves facing allegations of cover-up and corruption. In 2021, the death of Sandra Birchmore, a pregnant 23-year-old who had been found hanging in her apartment by the strap of her gym bag, was ruled a suicide. The following year, three Stoughton police officers, Robert Devine, Matthew Farwell, and William Farwell, the latter two are twin brothers, were found to have engaged in sexual relations with Birchmore after meeting her through their department's youth program. In June, a forensic pathologist hired by Birchmore's family determined her death was homicide by strangulation. In August, federal prosecutors charged Matthew Farwell with murdering Birchmore to cover up a sexual relationship that began when she was underage and resulted in her pregnancy. When it became clear to Mr. Farwell that he could no longer control Sandra Birchmore, he allegedly silenced her permanently, said Joshua Levy, acting U.S. attorney for Massachusetts, shortly after Farwell's arrest. Farwell stands accused of staging her death to look like a suicide just hours before the officer's wife gave birth to their third child. Farwell has pleaded not guilty. A 45-page affidavit outlines damning evidence that Massachusetts State Police apparently overlooked, like a new stroller in Birchmore's apartment and an appointment for a newborn photo shoot, both indicating her excitement about her baby. And while MSP said they had not found text between Birchmore and Farwell, the FBI found 32,709 between the two, as well as messages from Birchmore to her friends. About a week before her death, she texted one that Farwell had dropped by in an upbeat mood. He asked me if I'd give him a key, and said that if I keep it a secret, he'll be around. Then he looked in my closet. I don't know why, I haven't figured that out. Days later, she was found hanging from the closet door handle. Turtle Boy. Before Reed's case reached national attention levels, it was a local curiosity, most obsessively covered by Kearney, also known as Turtle Boy. The moniker refers to a statue of a boy riding a turtle, which has become a lewd inside joke in his hometown of Worcester. As interest snowballed, Turtle Boy cranked out more than 400 installments of his Canton cover-up serial and hundreds of live YouTube shows, earning him as much as $50,000 a month. As off the wall as Turtle Boy is with some of his reporting techniques, I said, if there's anybody that's going to get this out there, it would be him. He answers to nobody, John Silvera, Reed's friend of 30 years, told me. Some of his reporting techniques were indeed off the wall or flat out aggressive. He confronted McCabe at her daughter's lacrosse game to ask her about the hose long to die, the how long to die in the cold search. He was asked to leave. He appeared at a Canton government meeting where Chris Albert is on the board, holding a sign that read, Chris Albert killed a man, in reference to the 1994 crash. When I believe in something, I don't just say, oh, here's the facts. I go out and I hold protest, Kearney told me. So that's what he began doing. If you believe Reed is innocent, Turtle Boy's in-your-face approach is catharsis in the face of brazen corruption. If you believe Reed is guilty, Turtle Boy is an abhorrent opportunist. Outside the Dedham courthouse in August, before a Reed hearing, a woman in a blue Justice for JJ shirt tells me Turtle Boy is a despicable human being because of what he has done. Pointing to pink-clad, free Karen Reed supporters, she says, and these are all his followers. When the blue shirts start chanting Justice for JJ, the pink side joins in. A woman in pink peace sign earrings tells me they don't understand that we want justice for JJ too. 6 months into his coverage, Kearney was arrested and charged with witness intimidation. Before the Commonwealth served him a second helping of charges, Kearney served 60 days in jail after his bail was revoked because of an assault charge that, according to the Boston Herald, has since been dropped. Kearney maintains his innocence. As part of its case against Turtle Boy, the Commonwealth revealed that Kearney and Reed logged 189 phone calls. Karen's the subject of my reporting, and I spoke to her, confirms Kearney. That's traditionally known as journalism. In connection with Kearney's case, Morrissey convened a grand jury in March, a month before Reed's trial began, to try to have Reed indicted on charges of conspiracy to commit witness intimidation. The jury did not vote to charge. Had the DA been successful, Reed's bail would have been revoked, and she would have gone to jail. Morrissey declined to respond to all of Vanity Fair's questions. Turtle Riders, what Kearney calls his readers, sent him tips. One noticed McCabe's car, easily identifiable with a Vanity license plate, parked outside Proctor's house and snapped a photo. McCabe testified that Proctor was not home, and she was there to talk to Proctor's wife about the vicious harassment they received related to the case. Supporters raised $5,000 to put up a free Karen Reed billboard across from Gillette Stadium. The billboard owner believes so much in Reed's innocence that he's left it up for over a year without additional payment. In August 2023, Morrissey, whose office is in Canton, issued a video statement. The DA condemned the harassment of the families involved in the case and declared that Proctor has no close personal relationship with any of the parties involved in the investigation. He dismissed the defense's claims as a false narrative and conspiracy theories that are completely contrary to the evidence and a desperate attempt to reassign guilt. Never have I seen such unethical conduct from a prosecutor, Yannetti said in court, arguing for Canone to disqualify Morrissey's office from the case. She rejected the motion. Reed housed Yannetti, Jackson, Little, and herself in the same hotel throughout the trial so they could maximize preparation time. She paid $1.2 million leading up to and during the 9-week court proceedings between bails, accommodating, feeding, and transporting 3 lawyers, and hiring private investigators and experts. For that, she used her savings, about $500,000 from her since-depleted legal fund, and $400,000 donated by friends and family. She now has $5 million in deferred legal bills, and a second trial looming. The first one was trial on a budget, according to Reed. Since she couldn't afford to fly out support staff from Jackson and Little's firm, Reed became the support staff herself. She negotiated rates with 2 Uber drivers to shuttle the team to and from court. Reed is aware her team has been photographed exiting discounted SUVs and surrounded by volunteer security and dining out, the bill often picked up by friends or family members. As for criticism that her team occasionally enjoys upscale restaurants, she says, "You try feeding Alan Jackson McDonald's." "We don't typically work that closely with clients," says Little, who became partner during trial due to her long hours. "But in this case, we needed every hand on deck." Lock this whack job up. About 10 months after O'Keefe's death, the Office of the U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts impaneled a federal grand jury as part of an investigation into an unspecified federal crime related to Norfolk County's handling of Reed's case. The impetus is unknown. Levy will not comment on active investigations, and nearly 2 years into the probe, his team has not yet reached a conclusion. When the FBI steps in, that usually is an indication that they are in possession of some information that is extremely damaging to the law enforcement agencies involved, says Tom Nolan, a 27-year Boston police officer turned criminal justice professor at Emmanuel College, who is not involved in Reed's case. Last year, the Alberts, McCabe's, and other witnesses were subpoenaed to testify before the federal grand jury, according to state court proceedings. It is incredibly logistically complicated to pursue a federal investigation into an active state murder investigation, in part because 2 agencies are interviewing the same witnesses simultaneously. Zach Hafer, a former federal prosecutor and Cooley LLP partner, tells me, "I can't think of a time in my 14 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office where that happened. Presumably, it's some type of federal obstruction or witness tampering investigation, a cover-up of some sort." In these types of cases, it is common for prosecutors to grant certain witnesses immunity to help them determine what happened and whether there is a provable federal crime. The U.S. Attorney's Office has always prioritized the prosecution of law enforcement misconduct, says Hafer, pointing out that making false statements to a federal agent is a felony, carrying a 5-year sentence. So even if an individual wasn't guilty of the underlying offense, here, murder, lying about it after the fact to federal investigators is another potential charge. Shortly after the trial began, the feds provided more than 3,000 pages of findings to the defense and prosecution, including Proctor's text about Reed, a sampling. "She's a babe, weird Fall River accent, though, no ass. She's got a leaky balloon knot, leaks poo, waiting to lock this whack job up. Hopefully she kills herself." The federal investigation found that Brian Albert destroyed his cell phone the day before receiving a protection order to preserve it and its contents. Albert said the timing was a coincidence, and he was due for an upgrade. Also, that on January 30th, Higgins, the ATF agent who'd been at the Alberts, asked another federal agent for advice on extracting phone data. Months later, he drove to a military base to dispose of his destroyed phone and SIM card. Higgins testified that the target of a different investigation had found his contact information. The feds also determined that Higgins went to the Canton police station, where he worked from, after leaving the Albert home, though he was off duty and had been drinking. He says he was reshuffling cars. He spent much of the following day, a Saturday, when he was still off duty, there, passing through the garage where Reed's car was eventually kept, until about 6 p.m. The federal investigation found a 22-second call between Albert and Higgins at 2:22 a.m., 5 minutes before McCabe's alleged how long to die in cold search. The men said that both the dialing and pickup of those calls were butt dials. Though the federal findings were disclosed, Morrissey appealed to Canone days before the trial began to prohibit mention of the federal investigation in court, arguing that it would be prejudicial. Canone approved the request, meaning Reed's lawyers could not so much as utter the letters FBI before the jury. When questioning forensic reconstructionists hired by the Department of Justice, for example, the most Jackson could say was that they were hired by an independent agency. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico.